Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Virtus Quarterly Capital Market Overview. Please note today's conference is being recorded Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Barry Mandinack. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Barry Mandinack, Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. I want to welcome you to the Virtus Quarterly Capital Markets Overview. We'll be featuring Joe Terranova, Senior Managing Director and Chief Market Strategist at Virtus Investment Partners. Joe represents Virtus as a client-facing thought leader, providing insight into the domestic and global investing landscape. Joe is also a CNBC Ensemble member, appearing regularly on the Halftime Report, Squawk Box, and as a contributor of financial content across CNBC's media and digital platforms. Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Barry.
What I'll do is lead off with a few questions to get the conversation going, and then we'll open it up to the field for questions from the folks. So my first question, you know, getting a lot of press lately, people have been saying this is the hardest environment ever for retirees, an environment with low to no yields, equity valuations historically elevated by many metrics, and a lot of people talking about the death of the traditional 60-40 S&P bar cap balanced portfolio. So people are being guided for, you know, lowering expectations, working longer, spending less, and saving more. But beyond that, your thoughts on the current state of retirement planning and how a financial advisor should think about helping people get from where they are to where they need to go in this unusual environment?
That's a great question to begin with. There's been much popularized recently about the death of the 60-40 portfolio, as you mentioned. I don't know if you can get past where you began, which was tempering the expectations as we look forward, because that's the critical component of that conversation. We need to realize that the expected real annual returns are going to be lower. Now, in the past couple of days, David Kostin from Goldman Sachs put out a report, and he looked at the potential returns on an annualized basis for equities through 2030. That figure came in at 6%. That's what David's expectation is. Understand the annualized return during the prior decade was somewhere about 13%. So the significant contributor to the portfolio appreciation, Barry, was equities, and David's already telling us that that's going to be lessened dramatically. So I think the proper way to think about it is, first and foremost, reset the expectation. Secondarily, understand that we are going to, hopefully all of us, have a longer lifespan, and our needs are going to be financially far more challenged than they were for our parents or for our grandparents. Embrace the concept of saving, introducing that, and I think this pandemic has created an environment where it's teaching us that lesson. So that's the kind of, as I call it, the personal balance sheet behavior that we can adjust, understanding that those returns are going to be significantly less than what we've seen in prior decades. Now let's talk about actionable ideas within the capital markets themselves. Let's understand, when you think about bonds and we think about equities, what's the very purpose of a equity or a bond as it relates to a very important word, which is risk? So the usage of bonds is basically to hedge against the absence of growth. Well, look no further than what we have witnessed in 2020 because of the pandemic, the absence of growth. Now reflect back on 2019, Barry. You had record bond inflows. I believe the cumulative fund flows into government and corporate bonds in 2019 was $339 billion. So the bond market got right the 2020 absence of growth. initially, I think about equities. Historically, what are equities? Equities are a hedge against inflation. Well, here we are in the pandemic, COVID-19 crisis of preservation, as I've defined it, world, and we are certainly faced with the single greatest deflationary shock in modern economic history. Inflation is completely absent. If I look back on 2019, what do I see? Cumulative flows into global equities actually were negative by $208 billion. So the point of emphasis here is that because we have an understanding that looking forward, the potential to realize the gains that we have been blessed with in prior decades is going to be lessened, that doesn't mean you take immediate action in the portfolio. Because you first and foremost understand we are still living in a world that's absent inflation. We are still living in a world that is absent growth. So if I were to take away the prior returns of the past couple of decades, and I just was looking at the economic and capital market environment as it's constructed right now, I would say to myself, aha, I want to make sure that I have equities in that portfolio. And additionally, I want to make sure that I have a multi-sector approach to bonds in the portfolio. Now, understanding that, what I go further and do is realize that we have been living in the last 5 to 7 years in an abnormal volatility world that allowed investors to universally invest in an index in a very passive mannerism. And I believe with a high degree of confidence, because of this crisis of preservation, that world has changed. So now we're going to unfortunately have to understand that a longer-term ownership of a lot of the asset classes that we were able to kind of hold in the prior decade, we're not going to be blessed with that ability so much, okay? And we're going to have to, therefore, outsource our allocation opportunities to active management. And I think that's going to be very important. Lastly, you've heard me specifically in the prior quarterly call that we did speak about how diversification went on sale. Well, here we are one quarter later, and we're finally witnessing the consistent performance for diversification as it relates not only to assets, but geography, and to a certain extent by equity size class, and most definitely by strategy. So those are the four metrics that I introduced on the prior call. In particular, I really want to emphasize the geographic diversification story, because in this prior quarter, we witnessed the benefit of it. As I mentioned in the past couple of weeks on CNBC, the S&P 500 in the prior quarter returned somewhere around 20%. But if I go outside the world and I look at Brazil or Germany or Australia, I actually witness better performance. And that's a very unique circumstance. So collaboratively, we're tempering the expectations. That's incredibly important. We're understanding the environment, which is absent of inflation and absent of growth. And we're utilizing an active strategy that is incorporating diversification, which has gone on sale by the four metrics that I mentioned.
That's great. That's great, Joe. You know, speaking about diversification and growth, we've heard so much about the big four, the Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft, and how such a large percentage of the market's gains are coming from a concentrated group of stocks. Many people are thinking that it sounds like 99 and are extrapolating from there. What are your thoughts on the concentration of these super performers here? And do you think that has any implications for folks on the call who are trying to guide retirees and near retirees to get from where they are to where they need to go?
Yes, it most certainly does, Barry. And it goes back to the initial question that you asked me. Think about the concentration in terms of performance and in terms of the growth in market cap. So let me first answer whether or not we are creating a similar environment to 99 and through 2001. And what's the consequence if we are creating a similar circumstance to 99 to 2001? So we had at that time an over-concentration towards technology. However, at that time, please understand, technology was not the U.S. economy. What we are challenged by in that environment is that most of the ownership and allocations towards technology at that time were, number one, chasing performance, and number two, technical in nature. Now I fast forward to the world that we're living in now. And first, before we go to 2020, okay, let's look at the prior decade. And the big four that you mentioned, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Amazon, in 2010, collectively, those four companies had a market cap of somewhere around $710 billion. As we got out of that decade, the collective market cap for those four companies had risen over $4 trillion. So the circumstance of 2020, where we're seeing this over-concentration in terms of performance from the big four, this is not a new circumstance. What is a new circumstance, and the reason why this is not going to be a repeat of the 99 to 2001 experience, where once the over-concentration, the fever, so to speak, was relaxed or moderated and we broke that fever, what you experienced was a multi-year period where investors did not allocate towards technology, and technology underperformed the rest of the market. That's why you had the significant growth in terms of sector weighting for energy and financials. 2020, okay, if we are going to experience a relaxation in the over-concentration, on the other side of that, please know we are not going to experience a multi-year period where technology underperforms. Why? Because technology is the very essence of what the U.S. economy is. We have transitioned to a technology exportation economy. We do it better than anyone in the world. In addition to that, in the world that I described in answering your first question, where I mentioned the hedge that equities can be against inflation, the hedge that bonds can be against the absence of growth, right? Think about that for a second, and now think about these big four companies and understand the isolation in terms of where growth can be offered in the equity market, and it's very difficult to find, except for in these four types of companies. So really, what has happened is that growth has become the new defense in the market. And I think that's what investors are doing right now in aggressively allocating towards these big four. But they are all qualitative in nature. They all have strong free cash flow, low debt levels. They all can endure a contraction in share buybacks and still have a premium paid for their individual share price. They all have visibility into a very fast return to earnings growth. And then lastly, because of this crisis of preservation of COVID-19, we have pulled forward the tailwind that comes from ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing, and specifically identifies technology as the sector most desirable in aligning towards putting the stakeholder first.
Oh, that's very interesting. Now, speaking of COVID, obviously very significant conversation every day for all of us consuming is this kind of tug of war between, you know, back to work, working from home, vaccine, when do we resume some normal semblance of life? How do you think about this from a wealth planning perspective? How do you factor these decisions into your portfolio construction for clients today?
Well, I think it's more a back to normal. And the back to normal part of the capital markets is where the temptation is for wealth managers. And I would say that they're probably getting a lot of pressure from their clients. Why? Because you see very outsized losses in terms of share prices for the back to normal type of equity names, Barry. So whether that's travel, leisure, and we know what they are, casinos and airlines and hotels and some select brick and mortar retail. So the temptation, the human nature is there to say, okay, let's step away from what we know to be qualitative, what we know to be offering us the growth. Let's step away from that and let's have the entree into a lot of these areas because, yes, at some point we will introduce a vaccine and the world will go back to normal. What I would say as it relates to planning within the portfolio is historically, if you study periods of heightened volatility in the market where you see significant dislocations in price, what you'll find is any recovery in price for that very specific stressed component of the equity market that I'm defining, the recovery first presents itself, and not in the short term, but on a longer term perspective, in the debt market, not in the equity market. So I would offer for those planning to look for opportunities in the high yield market, in the investment grade market if it presents itself, first and foremost. And I use as an example what we witnessed for financial institutions in the wake of the great financial crisis. The next 4 to 5 years, you saw an outperformance as it relates to financial debt over financial equity. So I don't want to give in to the temptation when I'm planning. What I also don't want to do is not utilize, as I mentioned before, and I'm going to continue to emphasize this because it's working for the very first time in the last couple of years, this diversification story, asset class, geography, equity size class, and strategy. It's working. So I don't want to give in to the temptation to capture some form of equity outperformance and alpha chase in an airline, okay, when I could seek the opportunity in the debt market, or I could be seeking opportunities in the developed markets or the emerging markets themselves. Now, you related all this, Barry, to COVID-19 and the crisis of preservation. We are seeing a economic recovery that is either consistent to what we're witnessing here in the United States or in certain instances geographically ahead of what we're experiencing here in the United States. That, in addition to the actions of the Infinite Federal Reserve, where they're providing this tremendous amount of liquidity, and we're seeing a relaxation in the appreciation for the U.S. dollar, again, places me in a position to emphasize that alpha generation should be looked at beyond the United States into these developed and emerging market economies, and not giving in to that temptation in a very risky mannerism, highly levered to the back-to-normal stressed components of the equity market.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because I know non-U.S. equities had historic outflows in the second quarter. I know a lot of advisors have been trying to address home bias for years, and U.S. outperformance has persisted. So the flows would suggest that people are less and less interested in addressing home bias as a consequence of that. My last question before we open it up to the field, and it comes through a friend, Elmar Sacano. Being that this is an election year and a lot of conversation about the implications of this election being so substantial one way or the other, what are your thoughts on how one would think about the election vis-a-vis investments between now and year end?
I appreciate the question. I also appreciate your usage of the word think about. So I don't want to act. I'm getting a lot of questions in the last couple of weeks. Well, what should we be doing for our portfolios if the outcome of the election is as follows? First of all, let's reflect back on 2016 and not so much the U.S. presidential election, but the fiasco that was Brexit and the detrimental impact we saw on portfolios from so many that repositioned ahead of Brexit and on the other side of it had to scramble to position back to where they should have been. So I don't want to act ahead of the election. There'll be plenty of time on the other side of the election to act. What I do want to do is I want to create scenarios as it relates to the election and know ahead of time how we're thinking about adjusting the portfolio on the other side based on the potential outcomes that we're defining. So first and foremost, the most dramatic change as it relates to a portfolio would come from the implementation of policy that's uniquely different than the current policy, or further extenuates the current policy. What do I mean by that? Well, in either way, if you were to have a red wave, you would see an extenuation of the current policies that are in place. And if you were to have a blue wave, you would obviously see not only a reversal of the current policy, but an implementation of other policies that might directly impact specific sectors. So what I am going to do is I will address the blue wave, because if there were a red wave, which according to polls that I think everyone on this call realizes, I'm not necessarily sure they lead us in any type of productive direction, but if there was the red wave, we know the policies that currently exist. It would be an extenuation of those policies. In a blue wave, the most obvious consequence is actually not the one that would concern me in the potential outcomes for a portfolio most. And that might surprise everyone on the call. So there would be a tax consequence. It's been suggested, obviously, that we would see changes to corporate, personal, capital gains, and dividend tax. Everyone sits back in their chair, and they look at that, and they go, aha, that's troublesome. Yes, I agree with you. But what would be, to me, of more concern would be the tightening of regulations that in the last 4 years have been relaxed. That would have a negative impact on the energy industry. That would have a negative impact on select areas of the financial sector. And what is troublesome in that scenario is that we are conducting ourselves in an environment that is deflationary in nature and absent significant domestic and global growth. So what does that mean? That means that monetary policymakers, specifically the Federal Reserve, has been the continued source of liquidity and the continued source of fertilizing risk assets and the desire for investors to allocate towards those assets. What those monetary policymakers have been clamoring for in the last 5 years is help from fiscal policy. And if we were, Barry, to adopt fiscal policy on the other side of the election that would be restrictive rather than accommodative in its nature, that exactly is where I would be troubled, and that is exactly where everyone on the call They don't need me to tell them what to do. They would be strategically planning what portfolios should look like in that environment. But it is not so much the tax consequence as it is the regulatory restrictions that would concern me most.
Okay.
Now, let me just, Barry, one fine point on that. Please understand, two words, blue wave. So if we have a scenario where you have a Democratic Congress, a Republican Senate, and doesn't matter at that point, really, whether it's a Democrat, whether it's President Trump or Vice President Biden in the White House, you've got a process of gridlock that has been established where you're not going to be implement significant policy changes. Sorry to interrupt you, Barry. I just wanted to make that point.
No. What I'd like to do is have the operator open it up to the field for questions, please.
Thank you very much. We do welcome all questions or comments.
Barry, as much as I enjoy your questions, this is the part of these calls that I enjoy most when I get advisor questions.
I'm not hurt by that.
And our first question comes from the line of Ethan Lewin. Please proceed with your question.
Good afternoon, Ethan.
Have is in regards to your discussion with, you know, other geographies, not to be the
Ethan, I'm gonna, Ethan, I apologize. I'm gonna apologize. I'm gonna stop you for 1 second. I did not hear the beginning of your question. I want to make sure that I did. I said good afternoon, Ethan, and then I didn't hear anything. Could you just ask that question again? Sorry.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
I certainly can. Yes.
Okay. So the so obviously long-term returns being lower, I guess my question is with the outperformance that the U.S. has had for so many years, the valuations being so different, is there a thought that kind of a reversion somewhat to the mean, if not completely closing it, could with other sectors, other geographies, make up a large portion of that difference in returns and help the portfolios overall?
Yeah, I'm gonna answer that, and I'll ask Barry to kind of chime in also, because I know Barry does a great job in talking about this. I often say, to be fully nourished, sometimes you have to taste some things that don't taste too good at the time. And I think of it really as from a rebalancing perspective. So Ethan, if you reflect back, obviously, what's staring us, staring right at us? It's the prior decade and the significant underperformance that we witnessed, let's say, in the emerging markets relative to the United States. But roll that back to the prior decade, and we had a lost decade in the United States, and we had a strong decade for the emerging markets. So sometimes, you know, from a rebalancing perspective with a longer-term vision, especially in a world where the expected real returns are going to be lower, you have to think about two words, alpha generation. And I think that alpha generation opportunity, I always say this, everyone talks about small caps. And as I mentioned on the prior call, in eight of the last 20% decline since 1980, it's been small caps that have led the recovery. Well, let's now combine, that evidence along with my desire to look towards the emerging markets here for some alpha generation, and how about emerging market small caps, increasing allocations accordingly in the portfolio for some alpha generation there. So I think that's the right way to look at it. I also come at it from the perspective of where are currently doing so much from this infinite Federal Reserve in terms of the massive liquidity and their desire to make sure that they're halting that appreciation on the U.S. dollar. And as a byproduct of that, that's allowing for currencies outside of the U.S. to experience a little bit of a recovery process, that's allowing debt that's denominated in the U.S. dollars, obviously, to experience a little bit of a recovery process. So there's a little bit of a fundamental, evidence to suggest that it's the right time to kind of turn that battleship in the ocean in that direction. But there's just from the portfolio perspective and the rebalancing opportunity, it appears to me that strategically Although it might not feel so right at the moment, longer term, it's the right portfolio strategy. Barry, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, the only thing, I'd add a couple of things, which is, you know, we know that many people tend to buy today the portfolio they wish they owned 10 years ago. And so you see why such a large percentage of the flows go to U.S. Based equity funds. The problem is it's very difficult, impossible. Nobody can time markets. We all kind of know that. But timing when U.S. is going to outperform versus non-U.S. is equally futile. And so, you know, the best thing to do is to be kind of permanently globally diversified. And where the biggest frustrations tend to happen is people trying to time the motion of that. But what we know is betting against market cycles, betting against reversion to the mean historically has been a very painful thing to do. And the frustration comes in trying to figure out when exactly to do that, which once you're liberated from the idea that you can't really time it, then you just make sure that you always have a good diversification within your equities, across your equities, as Joe has been saying, geographically, style, market cap, and so forth.
Ethan, one last thing to also consider is the outcome of the potential election. Again, in a blue wave, globalization becomes popularized once again. That has an economic benefit and an asset price recovery benefit along with it.
Thank you for your question. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, thank you.
There don't appear to be any further questions in the queue at this time. However, as a reminder, to register questions or comments, please press 1-4 on your telephone. I will now turn the call back to you, Mr. Mandinac. Please continue.
Joe, I think I'll ask you one last question before we head out here. And it's around the ESG topic, which has been at the forefront of a lot of discussions. Current events have prioritized this stakeholder versus shareholder conversation. Can you elaborate for us what you're seeing in the ESG space, please?
So we're seeing a significant acceleration in the implementation of ESG. Conference call yesterday, I talked about it in the morning on Squawk Box. Jamie Dimon in the earnings release mentioned the performance of the quarter, mentioned the balance sheet, and mentioned the benefit to not the shareholder, Barry, the stakeholder, which is ESG, which is the client, the customer, the employee. So we're seeing a pull forward on this strategy. In the clearest sense of the word, technology, okay, defines itself as most aligning towards ESG. If you look at the largest ESG funds, the Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, and Facebook dominate as the top five holdings. In fact, Microsoft is owned by 55% of all ESG funds. Alphabet is owned by 47%, and Apple is owned by 35%. So you have corporations that are understanding this. You have corporations that are making a significant pivot. You have corporations outside of technology that are utilizing the very principles that support ESG. As example, Nike, Visa, J&J, Home Depot. These are companies that are embracing ESG. And I think it's going to be incredibly important for investors to give this consideration as we move forward. Now, I just want to, for a second, use energy and talk about energy for a second as it relates to ESG, because prior to this crisis of preservation in 2020, when we thought about ESG, it was about the E, and that was, well, let's not invest towards energy. And in fact, you're seeing a lot of the investment banks that are limiting credit to energy companies because they don't obviously meet the standards of ESG. So what do you do with that information? I don't think it takes you directly away from energy, but I think it takes you in a place where quality becomes incredibly important. Quality in the sense of companies that are strongly integrated, diversified by product, not just in the distribution of oil, but things like propane, natural gas, and even more importantly, liquefied natural gas. So there's a negative consequence for sectors as it relates to ESG, but the right portfolio behavior to be implemented because of that is just to move up significantly in terms of quality.
Okay. All right, great. Joe, anything else?
I'd like to see if we have any other questions from the operator, and then I just want to touch on two final points if I could. Operator, any other questions?
Yes, we do have a question from the line of Janine Mayer. Please proceed with your question.
Okay, thank you. Yes, hi. I've been in the business Hi, how are you?
I met you
like 20 years ago at a Virtus seminar when you guys first started your business, followed you ever since. I've been in the business like 40 years. This seems the longest time that value has underperformed core, but mostly value. And I keep going with growth, but I wonder at some point value has got to come back. What are you seeing on that?
So value is being replaced by quality. Value in the sense of, value has unfortunately become synonymous with the word cheap. It's a cheap company, right? We could find value. Mm-hmm. What I would prefer to do, and this is where active management is incredibly important, because you can find value managers who are utilizing quality and additionally momentum. And momentum is very important because you have all these quantitative funds, as we all know on this call, that are moving markets around on an intraday and a daily and a weekly and a monthly basis. So you have value managers that are properly incorporating quality and momentum, but they're more active in their nature. And value as just being simply defined as cheap and extrapolating value across, you know, the multi-sector approach, I think is the wrong way to look at it. There are value opportunities that can be found, but they must align themselves with quality and with momentum. And I keep emphasizing this need for active management, but it's becoming so important. Jeanine, to your question, as example, if you could, I want you to think about the Russell 2000, okay? And think about the Russell 2000 for a second and the composition of it. And I think for everyone on this call, this might surprise you, or if you know about it, it's kind of an aha moment where you say, yeah, it's been an amazing transition. Prior to the crisis of preservation, if I looked at the sector weighting of the Russell 2000 on February 28th, financials were 26% of the Russell. Healthcare was 19%. Currently, healthcare is now the leading sector in the Russell at 24%, on financials that have fallen down to 20%. So healthcare is a nice blend of value and growth, right? It's a nice blend of it. And the street is kind of looking at that and rewarding it. When we look at financials, one of the reasons why we're seeing the sector weighting decline is because there is a lot of financial sector that we can define as cheap, as non-qualitative, right? So I think it's important, and I emphasize that very strongly, to take the word value and what do you align it with? Do you align it with cheap, or do you align it with quality? Do you align it with momentum? And I think in an actively managed strategy, I want to allocate towards the quality, momentum, value concept over, well, value is just here and it's cheap, because that cheap is never going to recover in a world that's deflationary, that's absent significant growth, and that's dominated by mega cap technology. I hope that answers your question.
It does, but I guess I'm also looking at like the Virtus small cap. Of course, I have a lot of the small cap growth for my clients and the SMA and the money and the mutual fund before they closed, which have done phenomenal. And then you've got the core And I think I also have some in a small cap value from Virtus. And those have kind of saying like they've, I know their quality, but they've still, of course, underperformed growth quite a bit. And I keep wondering, should I keep it?
Well, as it relates to specific Virtus products, I'm going to just quickly introduce Barry back onto the call, and he could answer that question for you.
Thank you.
In terms of, you know, having growth and value on your books, I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, Kane has value, core, and growth capabilities, right?
Right. And
you know, when you ask Doug Foreman which ones to buy, he almost always quips with the idea, the one that's performing least well. So from his perspective, you know, that's the way he thinks about allocating across the styles and the market caps there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for sharing your insights and your observations with us. And I just want to thank everybody for taking the time of day to join us. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit us on our website at virtus.com. And if you have any additional questions or would like any further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. So, Joe, thanks again for your time today. Thank you all for your time today. Have a safe and lovely evening.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you, everyone.